get permission from my firstborn.
But when Judy had asked if I would share, at the time, there was a lot of things on my mind. You know, I had different ideas of what I was looking at. But then she had shared where her heart was to share on the mind of Christ, and Patsy's heart was on the bride of Christ. And I'm not sure what Yvonne was going to share, but I was thinking something along the lines of, like, of Christ, like the mind of Christ and the bride of Christ. And a lot had been going on, not directly to me, but in my sphere of influence, with a lot of suffering going on. And so I decided to do my talk on the perspective of Christ in regards to suffering. And but I, what I don't want to do is just say, here's what the Bible says about suffering, each verse, but although I am going to do that at the beginning, just so you know that there are verses that touch on these things. But really where my heart is if we had his perspective when we went through suffering. Suffering's just a backdrop. It's just a setting the stage. In that environment, if we had his perspective, would we suffer differently? And I believe we would. And then more importantly, we want to see him. And so not just his perspective, but who is he in the midst of our suffering? So that's really where I want to go this evening. And Lord willing, there's a lot of papers here, but it's really, most of it is verses. There's a lot of verses, and I know I handed out verses for people to help me out with that and read. So whoever has 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7.
I do.
Okay.
In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in the praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ.
And Peter
1, 6, and 7.
And what I really wanted to highlight there is that whatever we're going through, it'll be tested by fire and it will be found to result in the praise and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And then this is a verse that people use a lot in our suffering, and it's Romans 2b, the end of Romans 2 and to verse 5. Who has that one?
Oh, sorry. I was taking notes. We celebrate in the hope of the glory of God, and not only this, but we also celebrate in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us.
Yep. And that's a great verse, too, to use. But what I wanted to point out here was that it says that we know that our tribulations bring about perseverance. And they do. They bring it about. So as a result, we'll persevere, we'll build character, all these things. But the result is the revelation of Jesus from the verse before. Bring about and result don't mean the same thing. One will bring about these things, which result in hope. But, and if you notice at the end of the verse that Judy read, it says, because the love of God has been poured out through the Holy Spirit. And so really where I want to go is the revelation of Christ, because he's not promised to take away our trials, and it will produce character. There's no question about it. But more so, we want to see him in the midst of it.
That was Romans 2.
Romans, end of Romans 2 to verse 5. Romans 2b. Oh.
Romans,
I guess I wrote that wrong.
2, 1 through 5?
Yeah, I guess I wrote that wrong. I'll have to look it up.
Couldn't find it.
Yeah, because I only gave the verses. I didn't give the chapter, I guess.
Well, you can look at every Romans chapter.
There you go.
Verse 2.
I'm sorry. That's where my mistake was. But so the first few things I want to talk about, this is just kind of, it'll take a little bit of time, not much, but this is where I'm just going to share different types of suffering, and then if someone will just read the verse, just to kind of glaze over, just kind of brush over it, and then I'll get into what I really want to talk about. But suffering is very real, and it is no respecter of persons. We all go through it. We all have different degrees of suffering. But there are different kinds of suffering. And I wrote down, and you can write it down if you wanted to, just if you wanted to have it. Chastening is the first one. And chastening is involving God's discipline. Like when he chastened Israel, he wants to draw them back to himself. Whoever has Hebrews 12, 6, and then verse 11.
That's me. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness.
Right. And so it is for the purpose of drawing people back. And just as a caution, sometimes we can try to help somebody out of their circumstance when God is using that to draw them back to himself. And that's where the very next verse, Hebrews 12, 12, who has that?
Me. Therefore, you, the one who is being chastened, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather healed.
Right. So God is in the process of doing a healing work. And it's for the person who's being chastened, straighten your feet, walk the right path, and strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble. And then it says, so that the limb that is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather healed. And so I just say that as like kind of a caution that we can try to rescue people out of their circumstances, and sometimes it's not in God's will that we do that. But the next one is cause and effect, which is the consequences of sin. Whoever has Galatians 6, 7, and 8.
Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life.
Mm-hmm. And I was reminded of a time years ago. The boys were young and we were watching I Almost Got Away With It. Has anyone ever seen that show? Anyway, it's a show where it's a story. Every story is different with each show. But it's where these people escape out of prison. Sometimes it's one or two of them. And then they almost got away with it. They might have escaped for a week. They might have been gone 3 days. They might get caught that day. Or sometimes, like, one was, like, several years. Right. And he was caught. But most of the time, they call their mother. And so what the police will do is they will do a stakeout at the mother's house. And the mother comes to the rescue. And I remember, I forget which boy said it, but he looked at me and he said, "Would you call the police if I escaped?" And I said, "Absolutely I would." And he said, "Why? I thought you loved me." I said, "It's because I love you that I would do that." And so I've always remembered that, because it's out of love that I would call the police, because there's cause and effect. You did something and you got to pay for that. But there is a lesson in that too. But it is truly out of love. Sometimes we do run into situations where we just have to pay the price for it. There's just effects for that. Then there's suffering for Christ, like martyrdom. Matthew 5, 10 to 12.
I also have that. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
Mm-hmm. So I only bring that one up because that is a whole different thing, so that type of suffering where you are suffering, and we will, you know, some have even today and certainly in the future be persecuted for our faith, but we will have our rewards. And but that's a different type of suffering than what I'm going to talk about today. And then by default or association. And so by default, what I meant was one bad apple spoils the bunch, you know. Not so much like, well, it couldn't be like in a classroom, like everyone loses recess because of one person. But also, like the government, we are under, like, what if America's judged, we're part of America, we could be judged. That could produce a lot of suffering, but it's just that we're in that situation. So it's Romans 13, 1 and 2. Anybody have that one? Carrie?
13? That's me.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Okay. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. There is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority to resist the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves.
Mm-hmm. And that's just referring to the government, that we are under this government, and we might, you know, have to suffer for that, but we are to follow the authority that God has set up, and God is the bigger authority and over the little ones, even though sometimes we don't see it. And then 1 Corinthians 15:33.
Ooh, me. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals.
Mm-hmm. And that was more the association. So you might have to suffer because of, you know, just who you hang out with. And then there's a couple more. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Sorry. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they suffered because God was judging Israel, and then they were exiled. God judged Israel, and as a result, when the enemy attacked, they took out Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they went to Babylon. But in that, God used them mightily in a very powerful way. And Daniel 1:8. Does someone have Daniel 1:8?
Yeah. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank.
And then in the Hebrew, Paul just did a study on Daniel, and he said in the Hebrew where it says made up his mind, it says set his heart. And he brought up that point that when we set our hearts, that we won't defile ourselves. And this is just an illustration because Daniel learned the language. He lived in that. He actually went up the ranks. I mean, so there's many things. But in this particular case, he chose, I'm not going to swallow what they're giving me. I'm setting my heart. And he was used mightily by God. So even if we're in a situation where we have to, you know, living in this country, or we're just put in a situation, we can still set our hearts and God can still use us in that. And looking back, we would certainly see that. Romans 8:5-7.
For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law, indeed it cannot. Mm-hmm.
And that was, again, dealing with association, and mainly because it is crazy to me, especially in the work environment that I'm in, that people, they do crazy things, what they're talking about, and then they pay the price for it. And there is so much of that, and it's just, you know, if they would just set their heart, well, I don't know where they are with the Lord, but, you know, it just makes for a much more pleasant life when your heart is set on the Lord and you're living according to the Spirit instead of according to the flesh. And then the next one is ever-changing circumstances, or you can put changing circumstances, but what I meant by that was, it's the everyday things. Like, I lost my job, I'm sad. I got a promotion, I'm happy. I hurt my leg, I'm sad. My leg got better, I'm happy. I feel sick, now I'm better. It's that thing where we have life, and it's the emotion of life, and it's just circumstances change. They can change regularly, and our emotions change. And I'm sure you've heard before that, you know, happy is when you are relying on your circumstances, but contentment is when it doesn't matter what your circumstances are, but you have a contentment. So whoever has Philippians 4:11-13.
I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all things through him who gives me strength.
Yep. And that kind of speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. But Paul said, I've been in both situations, mm-hmm. but he has learned the secret. Okay, and then The next one is falsely accused. And that's from Isaiah 54:17.
No weapon that is fashioned against you shall succeed, and you shall refute every tongue that rises against you in judgment. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord in their vindication from me, declares the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm actually going to, my heart is, I'm going to be talking about Job, and he certainly was falsely accused, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about later, but that's a true form of suffering where people are very stressful. And then emotional stress or depression, and that's a big one because that's very prevalent today. I looked up depression. By definition, it says without hope, in constant despair.
Hmm.
Psalm 34:17 and 18.
When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit.
Mm-hmm. And then Isaiah 26:3.
Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee because he trusted in me.
Mm-hmm. And so, just a side note on depression, when you're going through things, the Lord is there and he does help us with our broken heart and crushed spirit. And then there is a verse that people take out of context a lot, and that is 1 Corinthians 10:13.
No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I'll see it on Facebook, I've heard it through the years, and they say, boy, God must think I can handle a whole lot because he's put all this on my plate, or I'm going through so much so he thinks that I can handle because he said that he won't give us more than we can handle. But the verse is he won't allow us to be tempted more than what we can handle. He'll always make a way of escape in temptation. The verse that deals more with, I don't think I can take any more, why is this all happening to me? The verse that I like is Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Anybody?
I don't have it this time.
Okay. Anybody have it? Matthew 11? Okay, I'll read it. Come to me, all who are heavy, who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And so certainly he gives us burdens so that we can then turn to him and give him our burdens. And he'll carry it. Okay, so that's...
Can I just share one super quick thing?
Yeah, sure.
I just heard this like not even a week ago. When it says come to me, I've always heard it like, come to me, like gently. But it's really like, come to me. Come now, come quickly. I thought that was... Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah, that is cool. That is very cool. All right, so I am going to... actually, my text is going to be Job. And when you hear Job, if I say we're going to talk about Job, what's the one word that everybody thinks of?
Suffering.
Suffering. All right, so that's true. But I'm going to give a little bit of background on Job. Who had Job 1:1?
I think I did. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil.
And then Job 1:8.
That's mine. No, that's not. That's yours. I knew I'd seen it.
The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil.
So we're all here this weekend. I brought up all the other forms of suffering. We're not talking about being chastened and coming back to the Lord, about cause and effect or different things that we're going through. We're all here because we all desire, like Job, to be righteous and upright and blameless and have a relationship with him. And it's just, it's a different purpose. And Job went through suffering and he was like we all want to be upright and blameless and all those things. And what makes Job's suffering a little different is that he didn't realize that Satan had put a charge against the Lord, that will he love you outside of your blessings? And I remember Dave Struve and I, we always said we heard my dad do a message on Job, and we both would talk to him all the time. Can you do it again? He's like, no, I'm not doing it again. And we've asked him, can you do it at Hashua? Nope, I'm not doing it. And both of us were like, we're going to get him to do it. We loved the series. It was great. We joked about it for years. But one of the points that he made was that Job was asking the wrong question, and we often ask the wrong question, and the question we ask is why, not are you enough? And the charge against the Lord was, are you enough when this comes into your life or when this is taken away? Are you enough? But it got twisted somehow, and the question became why? Why am I suffering? Why is this happening? And so that was why, like, it was just a really good study. So just to bring that up about Job. But Job didn't know that there was this whole spiritual thing going on. He was just living life, and all of a sudden his life is upside down in a day. And then also Job's suffering was all-encompassing. He was falsely accused. He lost loved ones. He lost his wealth. He lost his health. There were so many things that we might experience one of, and he had all of it. So he certainly is a good picture to illustrate suffering. But there are the background of Job. There are 42 chapters in Job, and only the first chapter and a little bit of the second chapter up to verse 8 talk about his suffering out of the 42 chapters. And so you think it's a book on suffering, but it's the first chapter. And then the rest of the book, chapters 2 to 37, it's where Job's friends are on the scene. And there's a lot of dialogue there. And I ended up, because I was studying this, I ended up reading and taking notes about everything, especially when the Lord spoke, everything he was saying, but mostly like with the men. When I was reading it, I'd turn it and they kept talking. And I was like, these guys have a lot to say. It was like another chapter. I mean, it was good. But it was just kind of funny. But yeah, so that's most of the book is really that interaction. Yes, it's their conversation. And then in chapters 38 to 41 is where God speaks. And then 42, Job repents. His friends are rebuked and Job is restored twofold. So I just found that to be interesting because we think of it as a book of suffering, but it's really a small part. And the interesting thing about Job's friends is that they did what we would think we would do also, or what you hear people say to do. Be there. Be there for your friend. They don't necessarily want you to give them advice. They just want you to listen or be there. And I don't know if you realize this, but when I reread it, I was like, wow. When they came to be with him, to encourage him, and when they saw him at a distance, they started to weep. So their heart was connected with him. They felt badly for him. And then they sat for 7 days and 7 nights and didn't say a word. They just sat there. They were just there for him. I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to do? And then I really wanted to do this, but I couldn't pull it off. But I wanted to have some verses in there, somehow play a game or something, where I would pull some words that sound so good. And it was the friends that said it that they were rebuked for. But it sounded so spiritual. It sounded like God said it. It really did. So I'm just going to just give you a little synopsis of the friends. Eliphaz, what he did was he reminded Job that as he helped others, as Job helped others in similar situations that he's in now, he was always encouraging them. But now that the tables are turned, he's being impatient. He's being intolerant. He also said that God spoke to him in a dream. This is what Eliphaz said. And he said, I was scared. I was scared of this dream. It frightened me, and I didn't even want to share it. And then he said, but God knows all things, and maybe Job doesn't realize he's sinning, but God will forgive you and restore you. That was Eliphaz. That was kind of in just a synopsis. Bildad reminded Job that God is just. Maybe it was the sins of his descendants. Seek God, and he will show compassion. Your beginning might be bad, but your ending will be great. Zophar reminded Job that he's justifying himself and acting self-righteous. God knows all things. That's true. These are all true things. Even if you don't know it, inquire of him, and God will tell you and make things right, and you'll be restored. Job, in the midst of the three friends talking, Job defended himself. And Job really didn't say anything that wasn't true. Because it was very interesting to read, because he said, I'm upright and blameless. God said in verse 8, he's upright and blameless. So it wasn't an untrue statement. He wasn't, the way I looked at it was, I didn't really see him as being self-righteous. I saw him as being honest. He was like, just tell me. He said, all I want to do is ask him. I just want to say, tell me what I can do. What did I do wrong? Because when the friends were accusing me, he said, I'll fix it. Tell me. And that was kind of where his heart was on that. He said that Job begged God that he would appear before him so he could ask him, what did I do wrong? I'll fix it. And then he was getting angrier as the friends were accusing him, being falsely accused, and he was defensive, as any of us would be. And we're like, I didn't do that, and I don't know why this is happening, but it's, you know, in some degree, it's embarrassing to him because they're assuming something, there was something he did. And then Elihu, or Elihu, however you like to say it, that was the only friend that really turned the direction off of Job and onto the Lord. And he said that God has a purpose, and it's just. He's in control. He tells Job not to turn from evil and don't wish your demise over your affliction, because Job had gotten to the point, I wish I was never born. Mm-hmm. And he said, don't go that far. You're afflicted, but don't wish your demise over your affliction. He said God caused it to happen, whether for correction or for this, or for his world or for loving kindness. So he changed the direction of the discussion. And it's at that point that God speaks, and he speaks in a whirlwind. And I looked up the definition of whirlwind, a column of air moving rapidly around and around in a funnel shape. A synonym is a tornado. And don't miss this, because God patiently waits for us to exhaust everything we think we know. Mm-hmm. And then he speaks. And he also, a lot of times, everything's upside down. And then he speaks. But he patiently waits, and then we're going to have our ideas and our ways, and then it's his turn to speak. And so that's what we really want to see. The very first thing God says, Job 38:2. Who has that?
Who is that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?
That's a very powerful verse. First thing he says after listening, I don't know how long. Live long.
Pages and pages.
Very first thing he says is, who is this that darkens counsel? Those are strong words. By words without knowledge. And it's, I don't want to jump ahead because later the friends are rebuked, but just as a caution, that we should be very careful about advice that we give that may appear spiritual. We really need to be before the Lord, because for him to say it darkens counsel with words without knowledge. But back to the notes. So what I'm going to do, the way I have the papers, I have God's perspective, and then next to it, it's the revelation of Christ. And so that's kind of how I want to go about it, and then hopefully you'll see where my heart is on this study. But the first point I want to make is that from God's perspective, he is sovereign. When you first read God responding, it sounds like he's sarcastic. But you know he's not, because he can't sin. So he's not. But it says, gird up your loins like a man. I'll ask you, and you instruct me. And it almost sounds like a taunt, like a, you know, sarcasm. But what I think he was saying right at the beginning was, you don't know what you're talking about. Because he said, who is it that darkens counsel? The friends and Job's responses to some degree. And I think he was saying, you don't know what you're talking about. Your assessment of the situation is unfounded. So he said, you instruct me. Like, it's like the student instructing the teacher kind of thing. because I know what I'm talking about. You know, that's, I think, where he was coming from more so. And so the revelation that I see here, and I'll develop it, is creator. He knows everything about his creation because he created it and he designed it. And that's where his sovereignty comes in. So from his perspective, he's in full control. And so a few illustrations I wanted to give. One was Hope Holloway. Mm-hmm. And she taught me how to make the communion bread. And I know, and I'm also thinking of her sticky buns. She taught a lot of people how to make sticky buns. Okay. She may not have created that recipe on her own, but she knew those recipes in and out. And she, with the communion bread, she had the whole story of Jesus and dying and the fork and the, yeah, I know. She went through all of it with me, and I loved it. And it meant so much to her. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody she heard talking about it, she'd be like, who are you without knowledge? You know what I mean? Like, let me tell you what it means, you know what I mean? Because it meant so much to her.
Yeah.
Same thing with the sticky buns. I know Ida can attest to this, that she had you go over at 5 a.m., right?
Oh, yeah. Christmas Eve. just because I asked her for the rest of it. She wouldn't give it to me unless I came over.
And she had to see it. You make
it ringing.
But that's just one illustration. But she wasn't the creator of it, but she knew the recipe. And so her knowledge of that, there was a way to do it. There was a certain way. You have to get up at 5 a.m. to do it. Don't just read the recipe. But then let's take it a little further. You got the mechanic. And that's a lot more intricate. You know, you've got an engine. But a mechanic who, especially if they're young at first, you know, as a kid, and they're watching their dad, you take it apart, you put it back together. They're learning the ins and outs of this machine. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, when some of us who go think that we know, they're like, that's not what the problem is, because they know the engine. And it's funny, because Paul and I, we go at it, because we had older vehicles, and it kept our van kept breaking down. Paul loved that van. And he said, "You don't know what you're talking about." Well, I'd get offended by that. I would look up all these things, and I said, "Paul, it doesn't make sense to me that we're going to keep putting in to this van, because it's not just 300,000 miles. It's 300,000 miles on the radiator, it's on everything. So when this is doing okay, this is going to break down." And so I would get frustrated, but he would explain why it's going to be okay. Anyway, it did last a lot longer than what I thought it would. But anyway, but the point is, he would say that. He said, "You don't know what you're talking about." And he meant it as, "I know what I'm talking about." So he won over on that one. But then you go a little further, and the inventor. Edison could certainly tell us 1,000 ways how not to make the light bulbs. And when you invent it, you know everything about it. And then the last thing is, with children, we are like procreators, like with little c. And not only do we know our children, but there's relationship there. And so it's not just that, oh, I know about this. You know, I've done it enough, like the recipes. Or, you know, I've taken this thing apart. I know the intricacies of it. Or I invented it. It's way more than that. And I think, when God started, he said, "Who are you to tell me?" And then he starts going in, which is going to be my second point, but he starts going into his creation. And I saw it as, if we could see him as creator and that intimate relationship, because I broke it down with children, but how much he desires a relationship with us, for one, but also that he knows, like when at the beginning when he's talking about his creation, and then he talks about the animals, which, by the way, I did not know. Didn't learn it in science class, but I read it, that an ostrich will leave her eggs to be trampled on, and it's God did not put in the ostrich to have that motherly instinct to protect the eggs, which I thought was very interesting. So they leave them in the ground, and then they can be trampled on or whatever, but anyway. And he said, "But did you know that?" And so when he starts bringing up these things, it's not sarcasm, it's that he is... Yeah, he is the creator of it. And he says, "There's so much you don't know that I know, because I made it. I invented it, mm-hmm. I created it, and then it's more of an intimate thing as well. Who has Hebrews 4:13?
And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to do.
Mm-hmm. All things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. And so he certainly knows every bit of his creation. And that brings me to the second point, if we had his perspective. If we had the perspective that no matter what we're going through, he's sovereign, and that we can see him as creator. And it's also true that in his sovereignty, the trial we're going to, whether he allowed it or he created it, he still is creator. He still is sovereign over all that. But my second point is God has 20/20 vision. We do not have 20/20 vision all the way. We have 20/20 hindsight vision. And we say that all the time, that that hindsight is 20/20, meaning if I knew then what I know now, I either would have peace about the situation, or I would do things differently, or whatever it may be. But we can only look at the present and the past. We cannot look at the future. His vision is past, present, and future. He sees the whole picture. And what a peace we would have if we're in the midst of something and we could see the whole picture. But we can't. But he can. And that's partly, that is why we can trust him, because his vision is so much more. We can't even comprehend it. But his vision is 20/20. What was interesting was when I was reading God's response in Job, at the beginning, he's talking about creation. And it was the past. It's the foundation of the world. It's about the ocean and how he makes it stop and the sun and all of that. And then after that, he talked about the creatures, which is the present, and how they birth their young and how they care for their young and the speed and the agility and the hawk and all these animals. And I was thinking, wow, it's like he's saying, I see the past, I see the present, and then the future. Later, he's talking about the behemoth and Leviathan and all that, and whether you take it literally or figuratively or whatever, that's still future. And so I saw the whole big picture, like when he's sharing, it's almost like I see, I know, like, what do you, you got to remember in the context of Job, you know, questioning, and he's like, you tell me, you instruct me, because I know the past, I know the present, I know the future. But he was talking about creation and his creatures on earth. And then there's like an interjection. I was trying to think of a good word. It's like he, as Paul would say, takes a rabbit trail. For those who know Paul, on his messages, so I'm going to take a rabbit trail. And he says, who are you, Job, to question me? And then if someone will read Job 40:6-14.
Oh, bless me. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm and said, now gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you, and you instruct me. Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Or do you have an arm like God? And can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, and clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Pour out the overflowings of your anger, and look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. And tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust together. Bind them in the hidden place. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you.
Mm-hmm. And so the interjection here, it was like the Lord was saying, who are you? This is where his self-righteousness comes in, because in a way he was judging God and he was saying, I don't deserve this. And so in his questioning, he's like, tell me what I've done. And when God came on the scene and he was talking about, you know, his creation and all he's done, and, you know, do you know how to do this and this? And it is amazing when you read it too, that we realize how much we don't know. you know, about this world and all the things on it and how much he knows. There's so many fascinating things. But it was like he was saying, who are you to condemn me? And so it's in verse 8. Will you really annul my judgment? So God made this decision. This is happening to him. Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Or do you have an arm like God? And so now he's saying, and then at the end when he says, if you think you can do all these things, that you can humble those that are proud and you can do all these things, and you can tread down the wicked, then I'll also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. And right hand, you know, a lot of times that's your strength, your right hand. But it's also, he sat at the right hand, Jesus sat at the right hand of the Father. And when I looked it up and I was trying to get some insight on that, or just from other people's study of it, they said that it was like Job was making himself an equal with God. He was at his right hand. It was like they were equal. And that can never be. But in essence, God is saying, if you know better than me, really, if he was saying, I've done nothing wrong, let your self-righteousness save you. You know, if you know better than me. And so it was just very interesting that in the middle of him talking, when Job really did seem to be saying, okay, you speak, you tell me, then he went into this thing. But I think this is where Job, like I said at the beginning, I didn't see really where Job went wrong. He said things that he felt were true. I really am blameless. But then when I read this, it dawned on me that he was really judging God in a way. Mm-hmm. It was like, so we can go through things and we're like, I don't deserve this, subconsciously. Or why would you let this happen? You know, and just even the questioning, and then God comes in and speaks and says, who are you? And it really does show his sovereignty still. And then, like I said, then he was talking again, then he went into the behemoth and Leviathan, which I don't have a lot of light on at all. I'm not sure why he brought that up. But other than I did see that past, present, future, that he is in all of it. So the second point is he has 20/20 vision. And the revelation that I saw of Christ there was his wisdom. I remember my dad saying once, a situation had happened to a friend of mine, tragically. It was a car accident. And you know, it was a hard time. And Dad said, if God were only love, then we could question. But because he's wisdom, we have to trust. And sometimes we only see him as love. And so we're like, why would a loving God allow this? Mm-hmm. But in his wisdom, he allows things that we can't fully understand. And so because we know he's wisdom, so when we're going through things, if we see him as wisdom, then we say, I have to trust you because I don't understand.
He's sovereign.
He's sovereign, and he sees the big picture, and he's wise. So that was the revelation that I saw on that one with the...
What was the revelation on the first one? I lost track
Creator.
Just that he's...
Yeah, creator.
Christ is a creator? Or?
Yeah, I just saw it as creator because he went right into his creation. Mm-hmm. And also it was the picture that he... It goes with sovereignty. I mean, it's his perspective that he knows everything about everything. Okay. And then the second one would be that it's God is wisdom. It's... Mm-hmm. And then who had Isaiah 46, 9 and 10?
I do. Remember the former things long past, for I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is no one like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient time things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure.
Mm-hmm. In that verse, it was that one part where it says, my purpose will be established. That's where his wisdom comes in, that we don't understand, and he will accomplish all of his good pleasure. And then the third one is, everything is redemptive, or you can just put redemptive if you want these notes, if it helps you. And then the revelation, of course, will be redeemer. Genesis 50:20.
Yes. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive.
Mm-hmm. Paul pointed this out. Touched me so much. That's what Joseph said in Genesis when he was referring to his brothers, mm-hmm. and his brothers sold him into slavery. And when he saw them again, he said, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about the result to preserve many people alive. Mm-hmm. And his point was that it wasn't just, although it was true, the famine was over the earth. And because he had stored all the grain, people were coming and he was preserving people alive. But it was much bigger than that, because Israel, who was Jacob, had 12 sons, and one of his sons was Judah. And Judah is the line of Christ. And Judah had to live. And the only way he could live is if he was preserved. And during that famine, he had somewhere to go so that he could be preserved. And then his line went down, and it went down through David and all the way to Mary and to ultimately to Jesus. And so he took it as, you meant this evil against me, but God meant it for good. And the result is to preserve many people alive. That's Christ. Yeah. And so it's not, so whatever, my point is, whatever we're going through, if we have the heart attitude that, if it's somebody against us, but regardless, that he means it for good because it's redemptive. And we have no idea how he's working in our circumstances for somebody else to preserve them alive, because it's all about Christ. And he's the Redeemer, and he's the one doing the work. So at this point, I'm going to tell a story, and I'm going to get emotional, probably. So one of the things that happened this year, which is why I wanted to go here, was my son's friend was killed in a car accident, and his name was Derek, and he was coming to our high school Bible studies with our group, but his dad is Buddhist, and his mom was Catholic, and they had a lot of Buddha statues out on their porch, but she had crosses and things in the house, so I'm not sure how all that worked with their theology or where the kids were at all. But we lived in Bridgeville for a long time, and for a few years, I was school choicing them to Georgetown, so I was driving the half hour to take them to school, and Michael was new in the school, and he was going to have a birthday party, or maybe just a sleepover, because his birthday's in the summer, so I don't remember exactly what it was, but Derek became one of his friends, and at the time, we lived in Bridgeville, and so I invited a few of his friends that he had met, and Derek came, and I met his mom. She was super nice, and it was, he was so cute, Derek was, because while all the kids are playing, he's up doing my dishes. He stood up on my stool and started doing my dishes. I said, Derek, go play. And he said, no, I want to do this for you. And I said, oh, you're so nice, but go play. But anyway, he was just such a cute kid. And anyway, so then we moved to Georgetown, and then through the years, so I dropped him off because he needed a ride home, and it was like way on the outskirts. I said, are you sure this is Georgetown? Are you sure we're going the right way? It was like near Lewis somewhere. I don't even know where it was. But anyway, fast forward, we moved to Georgetown, and Paul would say, I don't want to live in Georgetown. There's nothing good in Georgetown. There's no restaurants. My work's not there. My family's not there. My church isn't there. You know, he did not want to go to Georgetown, but it was easier for me. And I knew school was a short time, but, you know, it just would have been nice to be in the district, and because they were still young. And then we found a beautiful home, and so we moved to Georgetown. Well, wouldn't you know it, Derek's family moved two houses down from us in our neighborhood. And I remember thinking, after he had passed, just like was said of Jesus, not what good can come from Nazareth. There's nothing good in Nazareth. And what's good in Georgetown? And I thought to myself, Jesus is here. And maybe Carla, his mom, needed us to move to Georgetown so she would have someone to reach out to, because they need the Lord. So that was, I kept thinking, I said, there is something good in Georgetown, and there's something good at Texas Roadhouse. Jesus is there, and there's something good when you go to your appointments because Jesus is there, and there's something good about all of us and our influences because Jesus is there. And Carrie did a study on suffering a few years ago. She had, her church had a theme that they were doing, and one of the points she made, and I did start to cry when she shared it with me, and she was talking about how we're missionaries. And she said, at one point, my dad, which is my dad too, my dad has missionary congestive heart failure. And my mom has missionary muscular dystrophy. And you have missionary cancer. And you have missionary spinal stenosis. And all these things that we can look at, and those are just health things, but we're missionaries because everything is redemptive. He's using it redemptively. And all redemptive means is he's redeeming. He's saving, and people are being saved in our through. He's doing the saving, but through us. Interestingly, when Derek passed, he was coming to youth group, and I believe he had a lot of questions, and he did share, and of course I trust the Lord with that. But his mom was devastated, and I didn't know how to help her because I wanted to give her her space, but it's awkward. I don't know if she wants to talk about it or if she wants to not talk about it. You know, it's just this awkward thing. So I told her, anytime you want to talk, if you want to go for a walk, because we're in the same neighborhood. And maybe a week or two had gone by, and all of a sudden my Ring doorbell went off. And I looked, and it was her. And I jumped up and ran to the door, and by then she was already halfway down the driveway and going back to the street. And I said, Carla. And I stopped her, and she said, my dog, for some reason, just kept wanting to come up to your steps. And I said, well, good dog, good girl, Coco. Anyway, and so we went for a walk. And she shared a little bit. She's Hispanic. There's a little bit of a communication barrier. And so I think I caught everything, and I don't know if she caught everything I was sharing, but this broke my heart. She said, and there's a reason I'm sharing it, because you never know what the Lord's doing, but she said that a couple of months ago, my husband came to me and said, I'm ready to go. You have Derek to take care of you. And I said, what? I said, what does that mean? Does that mean he's ready to die? Does that mean he's ready to leave you? What does that mean? And she said, he's ready to go, I think, from the earth. Well, remember, he's Buddhist. And I thought, now, later, in studying this, I thought to myself, what if, and the Lord knows, his ways are much higher, but what if, at the very least, Derek was used by the Lord at the very least to save their marriage, but more gloriously, that he would come to the Lord because Derek was taken, and the Bible says in Ecclesiastes that better is the house of mourning than the house of feasting, because those that are living take it to heart. Everybody has that future, that unknown, that life after death, what happens in their heart. God put it there. And everybody takes it to heart because they know that we're right at that moment, especially at a funeral, we are faced with death. We're faced with it. And so my prayer has been for Fernando, because if through this tragedy, if the Lord, like Job, if the Lord could have come to Job and said, Satan is charging me with blah, 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 can I use you as my illustration? But you're going to have to go through some things. And can I use you? Whatever. And Job would have said, yes, use me. And then it wouldn't have been as, it would still be very painful, but it wouldn't. But because we are in the, I don't know why this is happening. I don't know what's going on. But in my heart, I'm thinking, if the Lord went to Derek and said, I'm going to take you home to save your father, I think he'd say, absolutely. But at the time, you don't know it. He's a kid. He's a teenager. And so you're thinking, okay, well, you know, I don't know what he would have said, but my point is that's how in control the Lord is and how much he's working redemptively. And when she told me that, I had no idea that would even come up, but the reason I bring it up is because redemptively, I'm thinking more, oh, I'm praying for them at this moment because they lost their son. And now I find that I'm praying for Fernando so much more for his salvation that I might not have been because I didn't know. You know, but now I'm like, oh, I'm really praying that through this, he comes to the Lord, that he really sees that, you know, the Lord might have done this. He needs him desperately. So if you think of him, pray for him with me. But that's my point, is that everything, there's a bigger picture, and the Lord's working redemptively. Somebody have 2 Corinthians 1, 3 to 6.
Yes. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we will be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. For just as sufferings of Christ are ours in abundance, so also our comfort is abundant through Christ. But if we are afflicted, it is for your comfort and salvation. Or if we are comforted, it is for your comfort, which is effective in the patient enduring of the same suffering which we also suffer. Mm-hmm.
And so it is true that if we go through something, we can certainly help someone going through it, if we've been through it, and can comfort them. But I really wanted to highlight, if we are afflicted, it is for your comfort and salvation. So that's just based on everything being redemptive. He uses everything. The next perspective is that Christ is eternal. His perspective is eternal, not temporal. We always look in the temporary. We're finite, so we look at the immediate in our surroundings, but he's looking beyond. He's eternal. And then the revelation I have is infinite. It's infinitely. And infinite goes in both directions. And so it's before the foundation of the world and into eternity. Ecclesiastes 3:4.
A time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance.
2 Peter 3:8. 2 Peter 3:8. Anybody have that?
Sorry, I was distracting. But do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years like one day. Mm-hmm.
And that's something we do forget, because time seems to go by so slowly at times for us, especially in suffering. But it really is quick. Isaiah 48.
The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever.
What was that one? What was that verse?
Isaiah 40, verse 8. And I love that verse. And a friend of mine gave me some flowers that look so real, and they're beautiful, and I love them, but they are like plastic, but you can't tell at all. Mm-hmm. And it said fall on the little box, but I wanted to keep it out all year because I really liked it, but now it says fall. So I'm like, oh. So I did. Just what I did. So I said, oh, I'd like to do something. So I ended up doing the reference, Isaiah 48. Mm-hmm. The grass withers and the flower fades, because as beautiful as it is, it's fading. But the word of our God stands forever. 2 Corinthians 4:16.
Therefore, we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day.
Yeah, and then 2 Corinthians 4:18.
While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Mm-hmm.
So that was that perspective, that if we see the bigger picture and that he sees things in light of eternity. And then the last one is for his glory. And the revelation I had, which I'll try to explain in a little bit, is he's worthy. It's worthy. So you know the story in the Bible about the man born blind. Somebody has that reference, John 9, 1 to 3.
I have that one. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him."
Mm-hmm. And so that just kind of speaks for itself, that people are saying, why is he born blind and someone else, you know, isn't, really is what I'm thinking along those lines. And it must have been that somebody sinned. And it says, no, it's so that the works of God might be displayed in him. That's another illustration of not just the Lord's sovereignty, but how he's working beyond what we understand. And it's for his glory. It's for his purpose. Some of you don't know, most of you do know about Hannah and Ryan and what they went through recently, but I'll just share very briefly because it's getting long, I apologize, and also because a lot of you already know the story. But I want to get to the point on what I'm going to share regarding this. But Carrie's daughter, Hannah, is married to Ryan, and Ryan's been struggling with a cough. And then he started coughing up blood and more recently. But he had gone to the doctor, I guess, throughout to try to deal with it. They said, oh, you know, it's the weather, you know, it's dry, you know, you get a bloody nose. It's kind of like that. Or allergies or whatever, any other things they thought it might be. Yeah. Anyway, and then so he had, did he have an MRI? What did he have done?
X-rays.
Oh, he had X-rays. Anyway. He had his appointment follow-up, and the follow-up said that he had pulmonary fibrosis, and he was given 3 to 5 years. At the most, they said it's not curable. And in the midst of some research, we found a clinic that's done clinical trials where he could go to California, and they have done it on rats or mice, but they haven't done it on humans, but he was going to be participate in that if he was accepted. And that was, apparently, there's a zinc protein. The zinc is very good, and it actually reverses, not just heals the lungs and that tissue, but it reverses it. But they're missing this zinc protein. And so they found that mice that had normal lungs had this protein, and the other mice that had this fibrosis did not. And so I guess they somehow gave the one mouse zinc protein, and it started to reverse everything. So that was the study. And he got accepted the next day. He inquired. They said, send your records. I mean, from California. And next day, and then he was on a plane in a few days, and he was, on a Saturday, he was headed to California. We were praising the Lord. And then he goes there, and they did tests right away. They said, come in. You don't need an appointment. Come in. We know you're coming from out of state. And he goes in, and they did the test. They said it'd be 24 hours.
Well, can I? No, they said that even though they saw the scans from his pulmonologist, that they have to do their own scans before he's accepted. So coming in is they were doing all their own tests, blood work and x-rays, and then they would confirm, and then he would start his treatment that week.
Okay.
So, but they needed to do their own tests to confirm.
Okay. So Ryan expected that after he was in there, he would then wait and then find out the results. But the doctor came in within the hour, right? After?
Well, he had his x-ray, and then he was waiting to go down to get blood work. And he came in before he went to get blood.
Okay, the doctor came in and said, would you like to know your results? And he was like, I think so.
No, yeah. You're not doing it justice.
Tell the story.
I'm kidding, no. No, what happened was the 24 hours was the blood work because it was in-house, so normally it would be more days, but they had an in-house lab, so they had to wait 24 hours. So before he went down to get blood work, the doctor walked in to pretty much tell him he doesn't have to get blood.
All right, so go ahead.
So that's,
No. So anyway, so he goes in and he said, there's no sign of this at all. And he said, here's the first x-ray, here's the second x-ray. And it was gone. And since then, Carrie, especially in that week, said, Ryan, how do you feel? Are you coughing? Because he would be exhausted, too. That's one of the symptoms. He couldn't do it, and he hasn't had symptoms since. It's gone. And then Ryan did say, can I schedule a follow-up? And he said, there's nothing to follow up on. There's nothing here. So we are praising the Lord. But in the midst of that, Carrie was sharing with different people, and because people have been praying and then sharing with some friends. And we were with a group of friends, and one of the ladies said, well, being is like you're Ed Miller's daughter or family, so then probably that would, you know, he's using you in a different way. And it kind of hit me that, oh, I don't think so, because God is no respecter of persons, you know. And I thought, but that's heartbreaking to think that, because then what if other people think he won't do that for me? And that's where this verse came in, that it says that it's neither you that sinned or your parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. And so I don't know if anyone watches The Chosen. Have you? I don't know if you've seen the latest. I don't want to do a... Can I do a spoiler alert? I don't know if you've seen all of it. It's part of my... That's it. I have to. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I already read the book.
Okay. Well, it's all over the internet. It's everywhere. That's true. That's true. Well, anyway.
That's good, Barbara.
You're at the end of the book.
So on The Chosen, the thing I don't care for... Well, let's put it this way. They have a lot of liberties, and it's okay. I mean, it's not that I mind it, but it's just not my favorite style, is that they will develop a story to get to the real story that's in the Bible and have it make sense. So, like, for example, with Peter walking on water, and then he took his eyes off the Lord and he fell, well, they developed a whole story where his wife miscarried, and then he was mad at God, and then during the feeding of the 5,000, he kicks the bucket, and the fish go everywhere, and all that, because he's just mad at God. And then they're on the sea, and that's when God says, come out, and that's how he got reconnected. It was like this moment of just reconnection. So I didn't love that, the way they do that, but I get it, because they're trying to make sense of why he fell and didn't keep his eyes on the Lord, so they create a story. So they did the same thing with Thomas. Did you see that?
No, we didn't see that one yet.
Oh, no.
Just cover your ears.
Yeah, just cover your ears. Well, anyway, it's much more powerful. It's much more powerful. It's much more powerful in the theater, which I heard it's not coming back for a while. You'll probably forget it.
That was so steep.
So go ahead. Okay, so anyway. So what they did with Thomas is they have been developing this love story. And because Jesus had the disciples and women that would follow. And so there's this love story. And it is really cute how they've done it, because at some point he goes like on a picnic, and then they send two disciples, and disciples are out on the, like, off to the side watching them, you know, chaperoning kind of thing. And anyway, and he proposed finally, and they're going to get married. And then they go back to the Bible stories, and Jesus was going to go before the Pharisees were there, but by the synagogue, and he was preaching. And they also developed a character that was like I don't know if he was a centurion, but he was one of the soldier types, or like up there. Mm-hmm. And the people were coming to him, do something, this Jesus is spreading lies and blasphemy. And he's just getting mad, and he grabs his sword, and he's out, and there's crowds. I mean, they really developed this. And then people start to scatter. But in the meantime, Jesus and the Pharisees are in this heated discussion. And it was a really good scene. Anyway, right at the end, it's kind of dispersing. Jesus is walking away, and the soldier stabs Rhema, the fiance, and she dies.
I didn't see that
part.
Sorry.
It was horrible. It was horrible. And that's how they ended the movie. That's how they ended it.
Spoiler, spoiler.
I'm so sorry. But maybe we shouldn't.
I used to like you.
I'm so sorry. Listen. Listen, you're going to love this principle. It was so powerful, but I'll tell you, there was a missed opportunity. Now, there was a lot of controversy online about it because, like, one guy, I listened to him, and he said, this is so unbiblical because there was never a time that someone asked for healing that he didn't heal in the Old Testament, and that was his beef about it. And then other people said they shouldn't have done that. It wasn't necessary. There was many things, but it took a long time to find it because they do not have clips online. But then finally they had a commentator that said the exact lines because I was trying to remember how it was worded. And here's how it went down. Beverly and Patsy.
Repeat the story. Okay.
It was so powerful. Thomas, it happens and she kind of falls. And he goes over, and then Jesus hears the commotion. He knows, because he's Jesus. He turns around, and he's coming back. And the look on Thomas's face, and he's like this, and he said, heal her. Fix this. You're here now, Rabbi, please. This was a mistake. And Jesus said, I'm so sorry. And then Thomas said, Rabbi, you don't have to let this happen. Just take it back. Take it back. She might not be dead yet. You can heal, right? And the look on the face was like, I'm one of your followers. I've seen this so many times. And so he was like, right? And it was like this, like they did a great job at, you know, making that plea. And Jesus said, it's not her time. I love you, Thomas. He loves you. I'm so sorry. Here's the missed opportunity I felt that was done, and it was what Jesus said. And it's fine that he said, I love you and I'm so sorry. But when Thomas said, make it right, you can heal, right? You can fix this, right? What I wish he had said was John 6:38, for I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Or Philippians 2:13, for it is God who is at work in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. And the reason I bring that up is because it's very hard because people's like, he wouldn't do that for me. And I can picture this. What about, I know you can do it. You've done it for this person, right? Right? And then he says, it's about my glory. It's about my pleasure. And the principle I got from it, I mean, it is, everything's for his glory, but it's that my dad's sphere of influence may be different and it trickles down, but we all have our own free will. And so anybody at any time who takes their eyes off the Lord, there's nothing special there, but whatever the Lord's using that sphere of influence to touch, again, it's redemptive and he's working. And then someone else is going through something and it's that sphere of influence and that sphere of influence. And we are at a place where we might not ever meet that person, but that person had an opportunity to witness there or be there because of their circumstances or because maybe they weren't healed. There's just so many things that go into it. And then I got thinking about my brother, John, who is deaf. He's the only one out of all of us who is deaf. And he doesn't take it as a handicap, but it is a handicap in that he can't enjoy music. And there's many things that he misses out on. He also lost a child at 2 months old. And all of us kids, 6 kids, he could very well say, why me? Mm-hmm. You know, there's 6, you know, and I have this. And then he has gotten this tumor that's wrapped around his spine. He's had almost half of his rib cage removed already. And he has tissue and he's in pain constantly. And so I called him up through Marco Polo and I asked him, I said, in all these years, what, you know, you've been through a lot and you could question things. And I said, I'm doing a study and I just want to know, what have you seen of the Lord? And that's really what I wanted to know, like not why or anything, but just, well, do you feel cheated? And what have you seen? in these years. And he said, oh, it was so sweet. He called me back and he goes, I mean, he's like, and he goes, I have everything to be thankful for. He said, I don't really know what I see differently. He said, now when it comes to Jennifer, which is his daughter, he said, it hurts me every time it's talked about. He said, it brings up like yesterday. And he said, that's hard. And he said, but he said, I have so much to be thankful for. And he said, I really can't. He said, I really don't know. He said, looking back, I see how the Lord used it. But he didn't, he said, like some people said, I don't know how you're getting through this. You're happy. And he said, I'm not happy. I'm depressed. Like he couldn't believe they thought he was happy. He said, I don't even know why you think that. I was depressed. And he thought he was, but apparently he, you know, the his Lord used him. Anyhow. Yeah. He was content in his situation. And then he did say that he was thankful and like he had a job that it was so hard and it just was so much stress on him, like we were talking about with Stephanie. And through many circumstances, and it had to do with he hired, it was so silly, he hired a hearing person and the whole community went against him because he should have hired a deaf person. It was all politics. It was terrible. And his name got spread through the mud. And he was so frustrated in those periods. And he said, I hired the qualified person, but that wasn't going to fly. So anyway, in the midst of all that, he lost his job. He didn't work for over a year. He almost lost his house because he didn't have he was telling me all this, refreshing my memory. And he said, but 5 years later, I am so thankful for where I moved to. And I love my job. He's in a different job, and he's a dean of a school of deaf kids. He loves it. And he said, 5 years ago, I would have never left my job. I didn't want to leave my job, even though I hated it. He said, I said, I didn't even know I hated it. but he says, looking back, and of course, like hindsight's 20/20, how the Lord engineered. So not just, I mean, the bigger picture is engineering redemptively, and he works all things through other people in our influence. But on a smaller level scale, he looks back and says, I'm really thankful the Lord did that for me, you know, even though it appeared at the time he didn't. So in that regard, another friend of mine, her name is Tammy. We were at her church last weekend in Pennsylvania where Paul spoke, and we were talking about this study too. And she said, the next day, she said, I've been thinking about what you were sharing about the suffering. And she said, what helped me when her father passed, she said, I couldn't get out of bed for a long time. But then she said, I have a lot to be thankful for.
I'm sorry, I had it gone.
That's all right.
No
problem. And she said, I think thankfulness is a big thing. Because if you're thankful, then you aren't really so much... she said, I got up out of bed and I started functioning because I was so thankful for some of the other things. Because she had children to take care of and all that. And then she said, it was okay. So I just bring that up because of John saying that. And then she said that he just says, we have so much to be thankful for. My dad recently, he has been studying John. I knew that. And he recently did one of his studies, and he was talking about the storm. And, of course, I'm thinking about all this. And he was talking about the storm is raging, you know, and then the storm settles, and he uses this principles. But I thought of my friend Carla, and I said, that's a great principle, but her storm is forever. Her storm didn't stop. But then the Lord quickened me very quickly, and it was the storm in her heart. So your circumstances might not change, but that storm, because I was thinking, yeah, it's a great story because the storm's going on, then it's calm. And then they're talking about it the next day. Remember that storm? But they're out of it. But what about those that are in the storm and it's not going away? And then it dawned on me that there's a storm. You can have a storm in your heart or you can be at peace. And you can have that calm, but it's more in the heart. So Philippians 4:4-7.
Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your gentle spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication. With thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. In the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus.
And so by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving. And so we should always be thankful. And then the peace of God, which surpasses, and it dawned on me, all comprehension. I always thought it was my comprehension, the peace that passes my understanding. But it's all understanding, even those around you. Like, I don't know how. I don't understand it. But and so that's also a testimony. I'm going to skip by some. I'm sorry if you didn't get to read. I'm going to skip some of these verses because it's getting long. There's one, Romans 8, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is revealed in us. And that's where the Lord gets the glory. How does Job end? Job 42, 1-6.
Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear now, and I will speak. I will ask you, and you instruct me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I retract, and I repent in dust and ashes.
And the 2 points I want to make about that is that, again, Job, for lack of a better word, was innocent in this. You know, he really was blameless, and he really said, what have I done? And it all seemed good. But when the Lord revealed himself to him during all that, he retracted. He said, I take it back. He said, I have declared that which I did not understand. That is so powerful, because it seems so reasonable for him to wonder, why is this happening? But things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. And then if you have it on your paper where it says, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. I take that as, I know the verses. I take the hearing of the ear as, I know. Yeah, it's a head knowledge. I know the Bible verse when you go to get encouragement. There's a big difference from reading a Bible verse and seeing the Lord, mm-hmm. and seeing the eyes, but now my eye sees. There was revelation, mm-hmm. because he knew the Lord. He had a relationship with the Lord, but it's at the point that God reveals himself, not just a verse here or there, but when he actually reveals it to you. And that's why I think sometimes we can encourage people with verses for sure, but it might not have the impact as when the Lord meets them and they see it. It's a totally different verse because the Lord met them and he showed himself. So it's about the revelation of Christ. And then one last observation. You notice that in all the things that the Lord spoke about, not once did he say the reason that all this happened and tell the story about Satan. Mm-hmm. Except, so Job may have never known it. Because, and my encouragement to us is that we don't have to know. If he knows, we don't have to know. It's in his hands, and he'll let us know what we need to know. But guess who does know it? The rest of us, the world, we all know it. He put it in the Bible. And so what Job didn't know, what he went through, we're getting blessed by. And I believe he's still getting rewards. Every time someone's blessed by his story, he's getting rewards. Often we want the why, but we really need the who. And it was at the point that he saw the Lord by revelation, and he said, now my eye see you. It's at that point that he said, I retract. I take it back. And what does he retract? He retracts what he thought he knew. He retracts his judgment on God's purposes and his self-righteousness, and then repent. Repent means to turn. And so what does he turn to? He turns, I'm going to say, from a perspective of we turn from all that we think we understand to faith. And it's not just faith in God's sovereignty, but faith in Christ himself. And then Job's friends are rebuked, and I already brought that up. Just, we should be careful. So, in conclusion, if we truly believe when we're going through things that God is sovereign, that he sees all, he has 20/20 vision, past, present, and future, that everything is redemptive, and that his ways are eternal, and he's working for eternity, and it's not temporal, and it's all about his glory, I believe we would suffer differently. Mm-hmm. And if we believe that he is the creator of us and of our circumstances, that he is wise, that he's the redeemer, that he's infinite, and that he's worthy, no matter what we go through, I believe we would suffer differently. And then my very last point, I promise, is I, as Dad would say, I speak as a fool. I speak as a fool to say, that's what Job's all about. Because that's exactly what his friends and Job were rebuked against. I can see God coming to me. What do you know? What knowledge do you have? And my point is, the last point is, his ways are higher than ours. And really, we don't know, because we are finite and he's infinite and his ways are so much higher. And I did want to end with one song that I heard that I absolutely love. And it's called Your Ways Are Higher Than Mine. So, thank you. But I will close in prayer and then we can listen to the song. And, yeah. All right. Lord, thank you for this opportunity that I've had. Thank you for everyone here. And we know that we all go through situations in our lives, good times, bad times, but we know that you're sovereign and you desire to reveal yourself to us. And we just thank you for the principles and for who you are. And we just pray for the rest of the weekend and all that we are going to learn from you in your name. Amen. Oops, that's not right.
Some
far above me. Your ways are higher than mine. I want mountains to move, but you want me to climb. So I wanna trust you will work your will in your time.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.